This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Scott Tobias.
Our regular co-hosts, Genevieve Kosky and Tasha Robinson, are trying to move some speakers that fell off a truck, but we're joined again by our friend Jason Bailey. Hello, Jason.
Hello, and in the spirit of the film we'll be discussing, Oh!
Oh, I think we went in the red on this recording very quickly. All right. So last week's show, we talked about The Godfather Part 2, Francis Ford Coppola's sweeping sequel to The Godfather. We were inspired to turn to it and the prequel embedded within its flashback structure by the release of The Many Saints of Newark, a prequel film to the groundbreaking TV series The Sopranos, co-written by Sopranos creator David Chase and series writer Lawrence Connor, and directed by frequent series director Alan Taylor. The film explores the New Jersey of the late 60s and early 70s, making the era look less like the golden age of Tony's memory than a time of turmoil, betrayal, and infighting. Familiar Sopranos territory, in other words. Alessandro Nivola stars as Dickie Moltisanti, the uncle Tony admired as a child and sought to emulate as an adult. We'll talk over the film after the break.
When I was a kid, guys like me were brought up to follow codes.
Hey, jerk off.
What'd you say?
What?
Antonio Soprano.
I wonder if I can talk to you alone for a moment, Mrs. Soprano.
On the basis of the Sanford-Binet, he's high IQ.
You can't prove it by me. He's got a D plus average.
Well, he doesn't apply himself, but he is smart. The results tell us. He's a leader.
Uncle Dick.
Growing up with the family takes a toll.
Maybe an ambassador to England or France.
You're my nephew.
Might like to gamble.
I want to do whatever I can to help you.
You may be a businessman.
My gift to you.
I want to go to college. I can't get called with shit like this.
Look, you take the speakers, right? At the same time, you say to yourself, this is the last time I'm ever going to steal something. It's that simple.
Okay, thoughts on The Many Saints of Newark. Jason, you're a guest. We'll turn to you.
It just feels so much like the pilot episode of a prequel series to me. It feels so overstuffed and yet shallow. I went into it very cynically, and it did not change my mind at any point. There's something sort of chilling about the promotional subtitle of A Sopranos Story, as in, like, this is how we're going to, you know, beat the dead horse a bit longer. And I guess I mostly came away from it feeling like, you know, like there are things in it that I liked. There are performances in it that are very interesting. There are isolated moments that work, but I never had a sense of what story they wanted to tell beyond a story that sort of winkingly included some characters that we knew. And there are moments throughout there. I really enjoyed James Gandolfini's son and his performances as young Tony. And yet, especially in the early scenes before he takes over, especially when he's a kid, there's just something very Baby Yoda about little Tony in those scenes and the way that he is, that he's framed and observes the behavior. The little Silvio, which was one of the main things I had heard people complain about going in, is really genuinely embarrassing. Like, and I think mostly because little Stevie is just such a distinctive presence and such a strange actor that attempting to emulate his mannerisms in any way is really going to feel like a nightclub comic doing an imitation of a guy. And there are little things like that throughout, like all of these little winks and like Livia saying, oh, poor you. And, you know, some of these lines that we knew later, you know, I had never really thought about Godfather 2 in these terms, literally, until you guys asked me to do this show and put this pairing together. Like, I had never really thought of Godfather 2 as the beginning of this thing, of the idea of the, you know, the pop culture origin story where we see, you know, where this little catchphrase or that came from or that sort of thing. And I'm not saying we should hold Francis Coppola responsible for that, but thinking of it in those stark terms did make me a little angry at what he had wrought, if nothing else, you know, that in my head, that always goes back to like the Star Wars prequels, I think mostly because of Patton Oswalt and his bit about John Voight's anatomy. But it's so throughout the film, just all of those little Easter eggs are so broad and loud and so clumsy that if he was trying to do something new or tell some sort of self-contained story, it's thwarted by those flourishes at every turn.
Yeah, I'll push back a little bit, not on the quality of it, but I don't think it feels like a prequel. I don't necessarily think it, I mean, like a setup for a prequel series. I feel like it plays like kind of a failed movie in a way, where Chase is, you know, he is trying to overstuff it. I loved his first film, his only film he's made as a director, which is not Fade Away. But it does also have that overstuff quality. It's kind of like he overdeveloped his plotting muscles on television and couldn't quite pare down for this. I do think it's trying to tell a beginning, middle, and end of something, but I don't think it quite knows what. I never really understood why any of this was necessary, I guess. That said, I think there are some really nice touches in it. I think Leota, especially as the second Moltisanti twin, the one who's in prison, who's a jazz fiend, who's grown philosophical during his imprisonment. Yeah. I love all those scenes.
Great.
I do like Nivola's performance. I think you could also swap in John Bernthal, who would have been good in that role as well. I think they both had that sort of like.
I think Carrie Stoll's excellent as well.
He is. And the scene that really haunts me, despite not particularly caring for the film, is the scene where Nivola's Dickie Moltisanti kills his lover, Giuseppina, who had been his father's wife, like drowns her. And the way that's shot, the way that almost like kind of like not accidental, but he can't believe what he's done after it's over. And just the way that this body just kind of drifts away and it's someone who's no one's going to care about. No one's really going to miss necessarily. And it was so easy for him. I feel like that kind of captures something about what it is to be a gangster, is like realizing what you can get away with and then how little the universe is going to punish you for it. I think there's some really nice moments like that. That said, I this film mostly just made me angry, you know. There's just
now I feel like defending it in a big way against both of you guys. So let's even though I wrote a mixed review and a red hot Substack called The Reveal, I feel like you're both being a little bit hard on this film, which seems, you know, very much at cross purposes for sure. We haven't mentioned, I think, what is really interesting. One of the things that's really new about it is drawing Chase's interest here, which is the riot, which is the mm-hmm. you know, and the racial divisions within Newark at the time. I mean, that's
a lot of potential there.
Well, it's a lot of potential, but I think it's also the story that he wants to tell. I mean, that's the story he opens with.
But he also kind of abandons it, though, is the thing.
Well, that's the thing. It's like what you can see so plainly, I think, in this in is kind of a movie at war with itself, and that it has to tick those boxes. It has to satisfy fans that Chase's are always felt incredibly ambivalent about anyway. Mm-hmm. I think you could see the last couple of seasons of The Sopranos as being a way of challenging and frustrating deliberately those fans right until the very end.
The one, two are really kind of there for to see Tony kick some ass, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I felt that in the preview audience that I saw it with too. Mm-hmm. We were terrible, by the way, absolutely the worst, one of the worst audiences I've seen a film with. So,
wait until the Rick and Morty movie comes out, and then you'll be
all set. We'll see. But in any case, I just appreciated that it is not a successful film. It isn't a successful film, but I think it's a film of that tries really hard and is full of interesting details. You know, the racial aspects of it are, you know, not fully developed, but they are developed in significant ways.
Yeah, I mean,
think about Tony's father coming back from prison, the only thing he can focus on and talk about is the fact that the black family has moved into the neighborhood, and how could you let that happen? How could people let that happen? It's terrible, you know. And I just think like that's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, and the fact that the city was, you know, had four days of fires and chaos and things that are quite conflicts that, of course, are extremely familiar to us in America at right now. So I appreciated the gesture there, and I also appreciated like the concept of Chris Moltisanti as a baby having his fate sealed and just being able to see that happen. And I guess we'll talk about that in connections to Godfather Part Two, because aspect of someone having their fate sealed before they can really take any control of it at all is kind of an important part of both films.
I think as long as we're also finding things to praise in this film, there's a stretch that I really liked. I think Fury for Margaret kind of gets saddled with having to do some familiar Olivia Soprano things, but the stretch where she meets with Tony's teacher, played by Talia Balsam, and then tries to be nice to her son, probably for the first time ever.
Makes him the cheeseburger.
Yeah, and then the way that falls apart, I think that is beautifully written and beautifully played. And again, that's what's frustrating about this film and kind of makes me mad at is, like, you know, if you can give me that, why not give me a movie that kind of coheres in a way that you can have more moments like that kind of flowing from one to the next?
Yeah, I mean, I think I certainly admire the ambition that you're talking about and its willingness to raise those issues and grapple with them. All I would say, though, is two things. First of all, the riots were one of the areas in which it weirdly felt like that should have been a section that felt most cinematic. And for me, that was the section where it felt most like a television show, because for some reason, the production value of that sequence seemed so chintzy. It seemed very much like a set that, like, had been constructed for a TV show, as opposed to, like, it just seemed very small and boxed in and just sort of like they were doing it on the cheap in a way that sequence wanted not to.
Yeah.
With the race stuff, I honestly felt, look, I'm not saying I need to hear the N-word on screen, but it felt dishonest to me that the sequence that you're talking about when he comes home and the scenes where that aspect of the changes in Newark are addressed pointedly avoid it in favor of softer language, as if they are afraid to make these characters too dislikable. And that the only time we hear that word is on Leslie Odom Jr.'s wife says it early in the film, and Alessandro Nivola says it right before he murders his lover. So, you know, he's a bad guy right then. And
yeah,
it felt to me like if you're going to deal with these issues, you can't soft pedal them like that. You can't pretend like this, like these attitudes were any less vile or socially friendly than they were.
Yeah, that all seems fair to me. I though, you know, I just think thematically it's, interesting that it's there at all, and that totally. and that character takes up such a huge amount of real estate in a movie that we anticipate to be all about the Sopranos and that family, that we can see these divisions within Newark, this attempt of a black man to run his own numbers racket and run his own gang, and a certain alternative kind of entrepreneurial spirit that these two factions have in common, but it brings them into conflict. I will say too, I think the big loser here is Alan Taylor. I think this is a very poorly directed film. And I also think maybe it's the writing to some degree. Actually, the entire thing all around, but the directing especially, is just there needed to be somebody with a different mindset of what a movie is and what a TV show is, because this thing has that kind of like democratic feeling that a TV show has, where it's cutting between all of these different subplots, and you can't do that with them. You know, that doesn't work very well in a movie a lot of the time. You know, you really have to have a strong, clear vision. You know, you can't do the A plot, B plot, C plot thing in a feature film, and I just think there's just a lack of detail. Again, that's something we can get into when we talk about Godfather Part Two, but it matters. The richness of these films matters, and if you can just contrast The Many Saints of Newark to the show The Sopranos, I mean, there's just no comparison in terms of just detail, in terms of like what the Bada Bing looks like and the back room of the Bada Bing and every other location of that on that show is so thoroughly realized. And this feels so glossy and off a lot of the time.
Yeah, that was the last thing I want to talk about before moving on to the comparison is how do we feel? What effect, if any, does this have on the legacy of The Sopranos? It feels like to me like it's kind of just going to be a footnote to it. And beyond one major plot development, there's nothing really that we learn about this, the past, that changes anything about how we look at the series. And frankly, I think you can just kind of pretend that didn't even happen if you don't want to deal with it, you know? Yeah. I don't know.
No, I agree. And I think even the, you know, once the actual Sopranos side of this film, the theme, this kind of poisoning of the well, where you have Dickie Moltisanti, who is going to try to do things differently than his father and doesn't. And, you know, the effect that we know his mentorship is going to have on young Tony Soprano, who is a troublesome but sensitive boy whose life could go in a different direction. You know, I mean, that's all. That's fine. It's reasonably well wrought, but that's also the story of The Sopranos. That's the story of, you know, I mean, that's Tony Jr. in the, you know, the bottom of the pool, you know, I mean, like that, it's that we could see how toxic, how poisonous a legacy, you know, that is being sort of passed along from one elder family member to, you know, a child without them even controlling it.
Can I pose a thought experiment here? I mean, this is something that really did occur to me as I was thinking about the movie afterwards. How successful, how much better or not would this film have been had Chase not been sort of straitjacketed by the responsibility of doing something tied to The Sopranos? And if instead he were able to just tell this story about crime in Newark in the 60s and the racial conflict that you're talking about and build these new characters that are so compelling and not have to make these other connections and feel obligated to include younger versions of these characters and so forth, but instead had like focused on Alessandro Nivola's character, who didn't have to be a Moltisanti, and focused on the two Ray Liotta characters, who are terrific. And it's a wonderful study in contrast for that actor and so forth and so on. Like, what kind of a movie could this have been? But we're fully aware that in order to get that movie made, he had to make it this other thing.
Yeah, I think you're just telling the story of the movie in terms of the movie he wanted to make and the movie that he had to make. Because I think the movie you're describing, I would guess, would be the movie that David Chase wanted to make. And I feel like that is almost transparent in watching this film, that he was at cross purposes, that there were these elements, these payoffs that needed to happen, and in kind of satisfying that, you know, he ends up kind of, you know, weakening the movie that he actually wanted to make.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think Not Fade Away is so filled with really rich, very specific detail of New Jersey in the 1960s that I think bringing that, you know, ability to you know, that sense of memory and specificity to a different type of story, I think he would have done, would have been well served. But that's not the film.
That got made.
No, I mean, and you can see it in the trailers. If you look at the trailer for this movie, you think the entire movie is the young Tony Soprano story, you know, and and the fact that that's how it's being sold tells you quite a bit about the movie they wanted him to make.
Yeah. Well, what can you do except to put out a sigh of resignation and find ways to compare it to a perhaps a better film. We will do. After the break, we're back with Connections.
What are you reading? Oh, can't you read a regular comic? I'm a Superman, Jughead.
It's about some Jewish girl in the night, and Robin Hood's in it.
I know they had Jews back in the Middle Ages.
Well, the Bible...
Anyway, your mother asked me to talk to you.
What, about getting suspended from school?
Hey, put that down.
So now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. I mean, I think the most obvious one is either depiction of different, you know, golden ages that perhaps weren't as golden as memory. I think there, to get things started, I think there is a certain degree of romanticization in the Godfather Part Two's, in Godfather Part Two's depiction of turn of the century New York that
definitely is
absent from Many Saints of Newark, which I think is a little more jaundiced of about that. You can't really call the Godfather films, especially Part Two, you can't accuse them of romanticizing the mafia, but I do think there is sort of this idea this is the pure period of the mafia before things took a turn, and you don't get that in Chase and Taylor's film.
Right. But there is the idea that that line of thinking, that way of thinking about the past is present in, you know, when we have one of those strangely irregular Christopher voiceovers where he in the transition between young Tony and teenage Tony, where he's talking about RICO statutes and so forth and says, I wish I had come before that. You know, this idea that things were easier slash better slash more fun, what have you, in the good old days, despite what we might be seeing on screen.
Yeah, I mean, these people are not having any fun. I mean, maybe they have a little bit of fun at the nightclub or whatever.
Right.
But their lives seem pretty miserable.
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, the show, The Sopranos itself, also gives a lie to that as well. And it's something that Tony kind of discovers about himself in therapy too, when they're really getting down to the roots of his panic attacks and these moments from childhood, one of which is recreated in the film when he sees his father getting arrested and experiences that kind of violence for the first time, and just, you know, I think it shakes him and has a profound physical impact on him. He's a very sensitive guy. I mean, that's something that carries over from Sopranos back to Many Saints of Newark, or forward to Many Saints of Newark, just like that's the impression of just like this is somebody who turned into the most vile, ruthless, you know, gangster. But he does have this side of him. He does have this sensitive side, you know, rooted in his childhood, you know. And I think this movie kind of allows you to kind of access that a little more. I mean, just like the scene with him. You know, all the stuff with him, the speakers, these stolen speakers. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the whole slippery slope thing, which is a big theme in Many Saints of Newark. But there's a whole kind of side bit in the film about Tony not wanting these really nice speakers because he knows, you know, they fell off a truck. He knows they're not legit for him to have. And then he reacts later against Dickie by throwing those speakers out the window. So at that point in time, he does have this kind of moral sense. But in any case, that is a very long-winded way of saying that, no, of course, these golden ages are not so golden. And I kind of, again, praise the Many Saints of Newark for showing a city that was, you know, on fire at that period, you know, where there's ash on Dickie Moltisanti's car from all of the fires that are breaking out around the city. You know, I think that's certainly does not look like a golden age, and which is hard whenever you have a film about the past, nostalgia tends to kick in.
I just wanted to add, as a sidebar to what you were just saying, I, as much as I have railed against the Baby Yoda stuff in here, I do love the way that you see how Tony's kind of a weird kid. Mm-hmm. And my favorite little moment of that was when Dickie comes into the bedroom and he's reading a comic book. And then it turns out it's like, it's a comic book version of Ivanhoe. As opposed to like reading an X-Men comic or what, you know, any other sort of movie in this period would have had. But that's like so in line with like, you know, his later love of like the History Channel and stuff like that. It really was a perfectly realized little character touch right there.
Yeah, there's like an Edward G. Robinson gangster film in this movie too, right? And Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah, Key Largo.
It's Key Largo. Largo. Yeah. Largo,
yeah. So his interest in classic films, you know, early.
Yeah. No. I mean, you know, we can all agree, Tony Soprano, vile guy, but good cinephile, good taste in film.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, he likes to try to get all the new equipment. He wants to watch films in an optimal setting when he sets himself up in the, you know, gets kicked out of the house and sets himself up in the pool house or whatever. It's a pretty sweet setup.
No motion smoothing for Tony Soprano. He turns that off.
No. And a nice connection. I remember this in an early season. They were watching the Godfather movies on DVD before they had actually been released on DVD.
Right, right.
I don't know why I remember things like this. I can't remember my kids' birthdays on the wrong day, but I can.
The DVDs fell off a truck.
Yes.
I do think that slippery slope idea that Scott brought up is another strong connection between these two projects as well, because Vito's actions, you know, I guess where you think they become unjustified is, it says something about who you are, you know? I mean, is holding a gun for his new friend, is that really so bad? Is taking this rug from someone who obviously has way more than they need, is that so? And certainly is exact, you know, using crime to exact justice in a neighborhood that is appreciative of your efforts, even if they are afraid of you, you know, that you can, maybe you can justify that. But at a certain point, though, you know, your kid ends up, you know, riddled with bullets by a highway, by a toll gate, or wherever it is in The Godfather. There's a line you cross, and there are consequences for that.
Well, and it's so painstakingly, those first few sort of moves into crime are so carefully painted as things he's doing for his family, as things he is mm-hmm. doing for the financial well-being, for the health of his children. It's very carefully crafted as it is all for family, the theme of family. This is what I have to do to keep my family secure and safe and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, that's of course, you know, a major connection between these movies too, is fathers and sons, and certain, like, you know, what gets passed on, you know, the dreams that these men have for their children, particularly their sons, and how those dreams are kind of are corrupted. You know, they cannot through their criminal actions
set up a world in which their children are going to eventually be prosperous and legitimate themselves. I mean, there's going to be a point in which, you know, they either corrupt their child or they put their child in terrible danger. I mean, that's kind of, you know, that was
the big theme with The Sopranos too. But The Sopranos is about by appearances, a well-to-do suburban family in New Jersey. And, of course, they're an uncommon family. And you know, the things that Tony does to for the people that he is closest to, all of it falls apart. I guess Meadow does okay. But
who knows?
Despite what, yeah, she has to watch her father get killed at the end. But come on, Keith. The whole family has to watch. Maybe they all get murdered.
Maybe. No, I don't think Meadow's actually headed toward a great future, one way or the other, at the end of that series. But that's a whole other. It's a whole other podcast. One other thing that, you know, they have in common is both these projects depict how crime is just entwined with certain moments in American history. We get the equivalent of the Kefauver, or is it based on the Kefauver hearings or different hearings? I'm not quite sure. But, you know, we get the mafia's moment in the spotlight where it becomes a public issue, and you know, this is more, there are no real legal consequences for it. We also get the events in New York, the protests and the fires and the looting and so on. But it's also, this is serves as a cover of crime. It's in some ways in changes the direction of crime. I think it's interesting the way that both of these handle it. And I think the Many States of New York is kind of on to something in showing how this action can provide a cover for crime as well, even if I don't think it's all that well developed.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, and that I think is one of the things I've always enjoyed about the Godfather movies in general, is just the sort of cheerful intermingling of real historical events. Some of the Vatican stuff in the third film especially gets really juicy there. But yeah, I think, you know, understanding the history of Newark, understanding the history of race in Newark is key to that thread, and the degree to which it is worked in is very Godfather-esque. Yeah, I would agree.
And also, I mean, you know, there are barriers to Italian Americans that are also made apparent in Godfather Part Two as well, of the senator basically, you know, saying that he doesn't like their kind. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not even like, and that certainly implies more than how Michael Corleone specifically does business or how what his business is. It is just like, it's a lot more just straight up, you know, racist than that. And so I guess those two, you know, in America, you have that, these kind of the struggle of racial factions that are at different degrees, I guess, of face different degrees of hostility from white America. Right. And that's what you get here with the Leslie Odom Jr. character, is somebody who has the same drive and entrepreneurial will and ruthlessness, I suppose, it takes to start a gang, to build a business, to do the numbers game on his own. But he's doing it in a place where there is just tremendous hostility towards him, simply because of his race. And it's a much more difficult process for him to try to establish himself than it would be for members of a more established crime family.
So this is almost more connection to the Godfather Part One, although I think the idea is resonant in both of them. But there is a moment in the Many Saints of Newark where it's like, you know, one character basically tells another, I forget the specifics, like, you know, you don't want to make even more money than numbers. It's heroin, which is kind of has an echo of Godfather Part One. When the Corleone family opposes entering the narcotics trade as well, there is kind of this idea that it's innocent up to a point, or at least forgivable up to a point. Do you see that idea explored in Godfather Part Two as well? Because I feel like at that point they've already crossed the Rubicon. You know, it is already just kind of, there is no kind of justifying what the family business has become. But I wonder, in Many Saints of Newark, it almost the way the numbers game is run and controlled, and the moment when McBrayer, Leslie Odom Jr.'s character, seizes control of certain neighborhoods is so violent, it almost kind of wants to push back against that notion that there was ever a moment when this was justifiable.
I mean, I think that's true, but I think it also, I think you're right that it is making the same kind of division between sort of like victim and victimless crime.
Sure.
And the way in which the numbers is handled in that film is a lot like the way that, you know, sort of more harmless ideas like gambling are handled in the Godfather films, that, you know, that numbers is something that's so innocent that even these kids are doing it, you know, and the sort of that kind of really wonderful tiny scene in the black owned bodega where he's sort of talking about numbers and fate, the proprietor with the nurse who's in, you know, getting her number for the day. I think I think you're right that it is really showing that, you know, the sort of the degrees of morality in crime are very present in both of these universes, and the sort of the idea of where that flip occurs is something that's considered, and I think for different people occurs at different points.
But in Godfather Part Two, I think there's even kind of kind of gives a lie to the idea that, that vice is okay. I mean, not only do you, or at least justifiable or victimless, because
sure.
not only do you get the dead prostitute, but, you know, a couple of points out the location there is a brothel that you fly into by private plane. So these women are effectively, this is their entire existence yeah. is being inside this brothel. He described wanting to depict that because he found it creepy, and it is creepy. It's extremely creepy.
I think that The Godfather Part Two was a pretty important text for the Many Saints of Newark.
And The Godfather in general for The Sopranos, too.
And for The Sopranos. But, I mean, this is a prequel, and you are dealing with the origins of certain characters. And I think there is that obsession, that interest that Keith brought it up in when we were talking about The Godfather Part Two and Sonny and the rug and everything like that, of just like these children that you're trying to do so much for being, we know their fate is being sealed. We have seen the sequel. You know, we have seen the future. We know what is going to happen to these characters.
Even if Christopher wasn't in voiceover, we know what would happen. That's true. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Chris, yeah, he doesn't necessarily, he comes out and says it, but this is the guy who killed me. I mean, it's maybe a little less subtle, but nonetheless powerful, you know, of having like, I mean, having him react the way he does when he first meets Tony, when he actually is a literal baby and kind of doesn't vibe well with Tony.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad moment. And then they kind of oversell it with the, some babies come from the other side with knowledge of what's going to happen right. to them or whatever.
Right, exactly. Why do that? It's right. Yeah. You know, it's clear that, we know if it's baby Christopher. And we've already been told, we not only do we know from the series, but we've already been told in voiceover at the beginning of the film that
couple Tony's of times
kills Christopher Moltisanti. We don't necessarily, you know, we can see his reaction to Tony as being enough without it actually being said.
It just overdoes it. And I feel like that's part where the comparison, it is not, you know, I think we've kind of gotten into some interesting nuances with Many Saints in Newark, but that's, any attempt to compare it to what The Godfather Part Two does with its flashback sequences is it really falls apart, because you do get a lot of the same stuff in The Godfather Part Two. You do get young Clemenza and young Abe Vigoda. I'm forgetting his character. Young Abe Vigoda. You know,
very popular CBS series.
Young Abe Vigoda.
I mean, I will say Coppola is not entirely blameless here in the sort of in the Baby Yoda stuff. Like, you know, there is the degree to which we work up to the first utterance of I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse. And the way that we circle around that, there is a very like Bart Simpson's classmates leaning in meme to the work up to that. Yes. Yes. Very much so. Yeah. You know, and I'm not blaming him, but he's certainly laying the groundwork for our current young Sheldon culture. That's all I'll say.
This is a little bit of a sidetrack from format here, but I just, let's briefly, it's relevant though. Let's talk about prequels. I mean, how many work, and why do we keep going at them? Because I think there's a handful of prequels that really do work. Better Call Saul is a great example. I mean, I think maybe that's a case where if it does work, that's an example of it working so well that it kind of justifies the continued attempt to do more prequels. But it's kind of a baffling thing to pursue given how rarely it works out.
I mean, Better Call Saul is incredible, but it's like that one is also like, let us show you a side of this character, the development of this character that you don't know. You just don't know. You don't know where this guy came from and how he came to be who he was. I thought going into that show that we are going to get, you know, something lighter, some sort of like Shaggy Dog type of comedy rather than a complete and devastating tragedy that it has ended up being. But it is, so I think you really have to show us something new. You can't just be plugging in, you know, the Easter eggs or whatever things or little hints of what this person is going to become. It's just, you know, because there's not a lot of tension. And again, Jason mentioned it in the previous episode, but that Patton Oswalt bit about Star Wars, the Star Wars prequels just has it right. I mean, you know what, you know, he wants a bowl of ice cream and instead he gets, you know,
rock salt.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I, and to further to that point, like when I was watching Godfather 2 and they were doing the scene at Ellis Island, I was like, oh God, is this what that terrible scene in Solo is supposed to be like referencing or
thought about that, but yeah,
paying homage to right. or something? Yeah, yeah. No,
there's a great moment. And it pays yeah. off again when he finally comes back and kills the yep. guy who killed his parents and his brother. Yeah. That was fun, yeah, you know. Yeah. Because the guy laughs at him being named Corleone. Mm-hmm. Incredible.
I think Better Call Saul is one of the few examples. And I think one of the reasons, I think, honestly, seriously, one of the reasons that it works, it surprises us with tone. It's also an origin story about a decidedly secondary character, about someone who is very much on the fringes of the original property, as opposed to most of the unsuccessful ones that we can think of are about how this specific lead character, beloved character, primary character became who they are. And I think that's where a lot of them fall apart, because you get stuck in those sort of expected, you know, callback / call forward conversations.
I'm just skeptical of the whole prequel idea. I Google good prequels. I'm already arguing with this list. Well, a couple places have listed The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly as a prequel, which I don't know. I don't buy that at all. It's a prequel to nothing. But let's see. I mean, Batman Begins, that doesn't count. It's the beginning of a new series.
Come on,
yeah. There's a film called The Godfather Part 2. That sounds like a
sequel. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
You have to scrape a little, quite a bit actually, to get to the good prequels, you know. Temple of Doom is even that's a little arguable, because you know it's not my favorite film in that series for sure.
Yes, the widely beloved.
As long as mass entertainment is motivated and financed on the strength of intellectual property, we're going to keep getting these. It's as certain as the day is long. There's no getting around it. It's another way to yield more quote unquote content out of things that people know and like and recognize. And that's where we're at.
So thankfully the end of that era is in sight. We'll be out of it soon.
Yeah. I mean, the new model is just making an incredibly weird film and then releasing it for one week,
one theater at a time,
one city at a time. Yep. Yeah.
Right now, Lamb looks like a strange little art house horror adjacent folktale. But when the Lamb cinematic universe kicks in,
I've seen the prequel to that. I got a lot of questions.
I do have questions about Lamb as well. Well, we've moved on from The Godfather Part II to talking about Lamb, which might be a digression upon a digression, which is probably a good sign that we can wind this segment down. The Godfather Part 2 is rentable through the usual streaming services, and of course continues to be available on Blu-ray and DVD, and there's really nice editions of the whole Godfather series on Blu-ray and DVD with tons of extras, including the commentary I keep referring back to. Francis Ford Coppola, not all directors give good commentary, but Coppola does. He's a good one. The Many States of Newark is in theaters, at least as we record this, and is also playing on HBO Max. We'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time for your next picture show, where we catch each other up on films or film-related items that you may want to seek out, too. So, Jason, what in the film world would you recommend right now?
I've really been enjoying the output of a very small indie boutique Blu-ray label called Fun City Editions, which is not connected to my book or podcast, Fun City Cinema, was weirdly just sort of coming together around the same time. But they're putting out some really wonderful little scene gems from the past. Last month, they put out an incredible edition of Rancho Deluxe, which I had never seen and which absolutely knocked me out. They've got one out this month that I've really enjoyed. It's a three-movie set called Primetime Panic. It's three TV movies from the early 1980s. Dreams Don't Die with Trini Alvarado, Death Ride to Osaka with Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Freedom with Mare Winningham, all of which are very good. Freedom especially is great. This really terrific character drama directed by Joseph Sargent, who did The Taking of Pelham 123, which is one of my favorite movies, and really has the vibe of like an early 90s indie movie. and really struck me as I was watching all of these films, but that one in particular, that our idea of the TV movie got so kind of corrupted by the sort of sordidness slash trashiness of them in sort of the back half of the 80s and the 90s. But at a really interesting point in the 70s and into the early 80s, I feel like these were filling a role that the independent cinema of those later eras filled, where, you know, they were telling sort of smaller stories. Younger filmmakers on the way up or older filmmakers kind of on the way down were getting shots at doing some interesting things. I enjoyed all three of the movies in this set, like I say, but that one in particular, Freedom, with Mare Whittingham, just excellent. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm looking at their site now. I remember when that project first launched, they did Alphabet City, which looked interesting. I'd never seen it before, but they put out some really good stuff. Like, I love Smile, the Michael Ritchie movie.
Wonderful.
I may have to go order that after we finish recording. Rancho Deluxe, I have not seen. It sounds really interesting. And it looks like they're putting out Radio On. Have you ever seen that one?
I haven't. I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah, it's a really interesting movie. It's kind of like this Wim Wenders-esque, I think he's actually an executive producer on it, journey through a road trip through late 70s Britain in the punk era. It's got a great soundtrack. It's a neat movie. Sting's in it, too, if that's a selling point. anyway.
So I watched that one last weekend, and it really blew me away. A lot of really good stuff in there. Keith, what are you watching?
So I watched, by coincidence, I was checking out Criterion Channel's neo-noir series, and I watched a film. I'd just been on one of those films I've been wanting to see for years, but never gotten around to, which is Across 110th Street. It turned out to be quite relevant to our discussion today, because it is a huge part of it is about the conflict between some black criminals and the Italian mafia a few years after, and in New York, not Newark, a few years after the events of Many Saints in Newark, but nonetheless, kind of the same thing. But it's this really gritty crime story that kind of takes an approach that would not be out of place in prestige television, where there's a central event, which is the robbing of a meeting of exchange of money between some black criminals and the mafia by just a group of three black men who see an opportunity and grab it. But then from there you get what happens to them, what happens within the Italian mafia criminal organization, what happens with the black gangsters that are already there, and what happens with the police characters, who are the closest the film has to focal characters, are played by Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto, who, you know, in two very great performances, Quinn playing an old school, quite racist, if in some ways well-meaning, policeman, and Kotto playing his someone who's up and coming, who is assigned to become his partner. They become kind of reluctant partners who kind of come to an understanding. There's so much, this is where I'm going to throw it back to you, Jason, there's so much New York detail in this. I shot in Harlem in the early 70s at a pretty rough time in that borough's history, where you get a lot of period detail. And it really does look like there were not much in the way of sets. A lot of this was shot on location. Even the interiors, like the police station, seemed to be, it just seemed to be a found location. I don't know if that's the case or not. Maybe you do?
No, it is. Yeah, that was all shot entirely on location. And it's a movie I always bring up when people ask me about sort of underrated or under-discussed New York movies. And frankly, the thing that I think is, if I may suggest, a different double feature, even from from what you're saying, is I've always thought that there's a really interesting conversation happening between that movie and The French Connection.
Yeah.
It almost plays like an answer record to that one, just especially in terms of the Anthony Quinn character, who really could be Popeye Doyle a few years on, but has this Yaphet Kotto character to sort of puncture the presentation of that as being sort of what it takes, and the kind of cop you have to be in New York dealing with these people, and sort of lays waste to those ideas. God, it's just a terrific movie. And mm-hmm. Paul Benjamin, just incredible performance, who is one of the corner men in Do the Right Thing, plays one of the robbers in this and has a sort of monologue of economic and social despair that's mm-hmm. just one of the most devastating things you will see in a movie, period.
Yeah, you really do get, he does, he's really effective at conveying the sense of a character who has, who feels like he has no other options and most likely has no other option. We should mention the director is Barry Scheer, who is really as much of a, you know, the definition of a journeyman who kind of went through the world of television. And it is, in some ways, it feels like in the best way possible, it feels like a 70s crime TV show done at a higher level. Yep. But he also, you know, he would go from that to, you know, I'm looking at his credits now, you know, Ironside and McCloud. He did direct a favorite film of mine, Wild in the Streets, the absolutely insane late 60s film about the first teenage president. But that almost seems like an outlier in his career. Scott, how about you? What have you seen lately?
I've been seeing a lot of films. I did a piece for The Reveal, our newsletter, about catching up with the Metacritic top 10 films of the year, of which I had seen one. So it was kind of a confession to being a very lazy person. One at the time. I mean, now it's populated by a lot of things I've seen and things that are coming out soon that were in New York and other places. But I was just like, I knew that I had slacked in staying caught up with films. You know, I'm a freelance writer. You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, I do what is required of me. And then I spent a lot of the early part of the year doing full season rewatches of The Sopranos and Mad Men and watching a ton of basketball and just not really engaging with film much more than what we were doing for this podcast, a little bit more maybe than that. But in any case, I caught up with a lot of things, but the most shameful thing that I did not see was one of the films that was nominated for Best Picture last year and won Best Actor. And I had assumed, despite Keith and other people telling me, this is a good film. Why, what are you doing? You need to see this film. My assumption is that this is just going to be a film play with Anthony Hopkins and that I would be, I just catch it at some other point. What's the big rush? Is this really going to be, you know, one of the best films of the year? And then I watched it and it's like, it's my favorite of all of the nominees. This is The Father I'm talking about. Actually, I haven't mentioned the name of the movie by Florian Zeller called The Father. It blew me away. It would have been a film that I would have put, I think, at number 5 on my top 10 list were I to remake it again. It's got a lot more going for it than the Anthony Hopkins performance, though that performance is exceptional along with the other performances of the film by Olivia Colman and by Imogen Poots and by Rufus Sewell and some other really fine performances in that movie. You know, it is a familiar story. We have seen narratives about people having dementia and you know, the devastation of that. What we have not seen, what this movie shows us, is what it's like from that person's perspective, that sense of disorientation of not knowing who you know, where you are, what's yours, you know, who certain people are. And you know, we know how devastating it is from the other side of that. I guess there was that Julianne Moore movie where we could see her kind of losing her way, but in any case,
there's a really good episode of Castle Rock, of the one real standout episode of
sure. So show. Maybe it's done before, but I felt like this was done with a tremendous amount of heart, and also it has moments of cruelty that reminded me a bit of Amour, the Michael Haneke film, but it is not in itself a cruel film in quite the same way that Haneke's film is. You know, it doesn't.
Are you saying that there's more warmth to a film than Michael Haneke tends to bring?
But it's still the same kind of power. I mean, you remember the slap in Amour, and here there are a couple of lines. Two lines in particular that have that kind of power where it's like, wow, that just, it just knocks you back with the cruelty of it. But it is a film that is ultimately very sympathetic and affectionate towards these characters. It earns and has an incredibly emotional ending. I loved it. I just really loved it. The Father, it's like, I think you can, unfortunately, you know, you have to have Showtime or still pay $20 to see it. It's still not the most accessible film, which was another problem when it was coming out.
It came out kind of late too.
Oh no. I mean, there's a lot of things, and it's Sony Pictures Classics, and you're thinking, they've done film. And I don't know. I think it's really great. So The Father, I'd recommend seeing if you haven't already, if that happened to be why did Chadwick Boseman not win? I mean, like, Chadwick Boseman is incredible in that movie, but Anthony Hopkins is, this is a top 3 performance from him too, I think.
It's up there. Jason, did you see it?
I did, yeah. Co-sign on everything said, but I took it didn't seem urgent to me either. It seemed like a movie I'd seen before. I watched it on Blu-ray for the Blu-ray column I do for the playlist, and absolutely took my breath away for many of the same ways that you're talking about. It's just that approach, the simplicity of it is it's so elegant, but it's so devastating and so effective.
And I mean, I think if we were to do a pairing with that, and we've already done this one before, but I'd pair it with like Memento, you know, I mean, yeah. Like that. And yeah. I think that if I knew like going in, like, you know, if somebody told me, you know, Scott, you know, this film will probably remind you a little bit of Memento, then that would maybe that would have changed my mind a little bit. Maybe I would think like, oh, why would it do that? It's just a film play with Anthony Hopkins. Good stuff, though. So The Father, if you slept on it like I did, sleep on it no longer. It's really good.
Yeah. Well, good stuff to check out. We'll be right back after the break. And that's it for this edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will be released on October 12th and October 19th. Scott, what do we have on tap?
In an oppressive desert terrain that's nonetheless strategically precious, outside forces clash while suppressing the native population. That is, until a young rebellious outsider comes swooping in and leads an uprising. That's the basic plot of Frank Herbert's seminal sci-fi novel Dune, half of which has just been adapted by Denis Villeneuve, the director of Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. It's also the plot of Lawrence of Arabia, David Lean's 1962 epic starring Peter O'Toole as T.E. Lawrence, a misfit British Army lieutenant who's sent to the desert during World War I to assist Prince Faisal in the Bedouins' revolt against the enemy Turks. As Lawrence ingratiates himself to various Arab tribes and unites them in a common cause, he's celebrated as a hero, even while he's distanced from Britain's long-term colonial ambitions for the country. In Dune, Timothy Chalamet plays a similar misfit of destiny as Paul Atreides, who gets himself involved in a war on Arrakis, a planet that produces a coveted spice called melange. Paul takes a particular interest in the Fremen, an indigenous people who have managed to thrive on a desert planet with very little water and lots of giant sandworms. So please join us for our next pairing on Lawrence of Arabia and Dune, and as Phil Collins might say, no still suit required.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The Godfather Part 2, The Many Saints of Newark, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Jason, where can we find you?
The book is called Fun City Cinema, New York City and the Movies That Made It, out October 26th from Abrams Books. The accompanying podcast is also called Fun City Cinema. And if I may, direct the Next Picture Show audience to the second season premiere, which is called Tribute in Light. It is about 25th Hour, and it features both Keith Phipps and Scott Tobias in a conversation about 25th Hour and 9/11, which was inspired by both of you guys' wonderful pieces on The Dissolve about that film and the all of the ephemera surrounding it. Those are my main things. I'm on Twitter at Jason-Bailey, all spelled out. You'll find my other links there. Scott?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias, and you can find me at the reveal with the Substack that I do with Keith. That's thereveal.substack.com. That's where a lot of my energy and most exciting work, I guess the work I'm most excited about, goes into the Substack, right? I also write for the New York Times and Guardian and Vulture and other outlets. I'm the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings, which, you know, should have another piece up pretty soon. Keith, how about you?
Oh, I'm a freelance writer. You can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000, where I link to a lot of stuff, where I write for places like GQ, The Ringer, Vulture, TV Guide, and also, as Scott mentioned, The Reveal, which is thereveal.substack.net. It's just
pure... Did you say net?
Oh, no, it's not good net. Lord, it's .com. Well, I'm sorry, I started
dot
another
TV.
Substack. That's Substack.net.
Like, no. So, you know, you can go to .com, but the real stuff is at Substack.net.
No, don't confuse them. The reveal.substack.com. We're doing a lot of fun stuff. If you like books. If you like what we've done in the past, you'll probably enjoy the Substack. You can find our absent co-host, Genevieve Kosky, at Twitter, on Twitter and at Genevieve Kosky. She's a senior TV editor at Vulture. You can find Tasha Robinson, who's a film and TV editor at Polygon. You can find her work there and also on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net and via Twitter at Next Picture Pod. You can also contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content on patreon.com/nextpictureshow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it, and please also consider rating and reviewing us, which will help others find your favorite movie podcast. Thanks to Dan the Bake Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time. Non c'è più.